Welcome. I think we'll still have people trickling in, but I think we'll get started. My name is Jennifer Cook. I'm director of the Africa program here at CSIS, and we're really delighted to welcome back Yaki Siliers, who's executive director of the Institute for Security Studies with headquarters in South Africa. Yaki is co-founder of the Institute, which was founded in 1990. He also played a critical role in the transformation of South Africa's armed forces in the 1990s and the reassertion of civilian control. ISS has grown to be, I think, perhaps Africa's premier think tank, and it's a truly pan-African in scope. It has offices in Pretoria and Johannesburg, but also in Dakar, in Addis, and in Nairobi. And it really puts out a prodigious amount of analysis, events, commentary, really excellent quality and analysis. And if you haven't visited their website, I suggest that you do. I also wanted to say, Yaki, since I haven't seen you in person, our condolences on the passing of Henri Boshoff, who was with ISS for a long time. I can't remember how many times I was looking into an issue and said, well, Henri is the person to talk to you about that. And really, we're sorry for your loss. It was an untimely passing. Today we're going to talk about the recent publication from ISS on Africa Futures 2050. It was a collaboration between ISS and the Party Futures Center, I believe it's called, which is part of the University of Denver. And it's really taking a look at some of the macro trends that will shape African future over the next 40 years, so out to 2050. And I think the last time you were here, Yaki, you were presenting Africa in the World 2025, which looked a shorter time frame. But it would be interesting to see how things maybe shifted in the comparison between the two. We're going to keep this fairly informal. Yaki will present the report, and then we'll open up for questions and answers. And comments and debate. So, Yaki, thanks very much and welcome.
Jennifer, thank you very much. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for being here. This is a PowerPoint presentation, and it's sort of based on the monograph. And as Jennifer said, it's something we published earlier this year in conjunction with IFSET Party. And hard copies of the monograph are available outside. They're also on our website, which is www.issafrica.org. And there's a lot of stuff, including podcasts and other things.
I don't know how to listen to
that. first, just a word about the ISS. That's sort of our mission statement. So we work on the broad concept of human security and to look at policy formulation and decision-making. And we are a little bit different to an ordinary think tank in the sense that we also do teaching, training, and we do implementation assistance. And we have offices in Addis, Dakar, Cape Town, Nairobi, and Pretoria. I am South African, obviously from my accent, but we're very much a pan-African organization. So we're funded by the normal culprits, the Europeans, and so on and so forth. Insufficiently by the U.S., but that's... The monograph is based on two sources of information. I need a laser pointer.
Oh.
I have one.
Oh, you have one. ISS is way ahead of us on the tech stuff.
So. I wouldn't say that. The first source is, of course, the monograph, African Futures 2050, the previous one, which published in 2008, which really looked at 2025. And this is the sub-modules within the IFS model. IFS with Party is a very sophisticated long-term forecasting model. It's a dynamic model that is unique in the world in terms of its sophistication, in our belief. It is widely used, amongst others, by the National Intelligence Council when they do their four-yearly forecast for the incoming administration. And so on. So everything is related to everything else in the model. It's not just a standard projection of where things are going. It is an extremely sophisticated system. Obviously, this is not a prediction. This is purely a basis for discussion. Nobody, luckily, knows what the future holds. And the only thing that I think I can guarantee is that I will be wrong. What I am presenting is what is known as the base case. The base case is how things will generally go if things carry on the way they are carrying on. It is not a scenario. We are, in actual fact, in the next phase of our project, we will be doing some scenarios. So the first thing that I want to start with is just the standard picture, just to remind ourselves of the size of the continent we're talking about. That is the United States. That is China. In terms of geography, people do not appreciate the absolute size of Africa. It is massive. 1 billion people, 2,000 languages, 53 countries, maybe in a few weeks 54, 55, depending on how you count, could be 56. So I'm going to generalize grossly and unashamedly, and I'm going to compare Africa with Europe and so on. Of course, you can't do that because it's 53 countries, but there's no other way to do this. So bear with me. You can pick holes in many issues, but I think that picture is very important just to keep in the back of our minds. We do not appreciate the size of what we're talking about. Let me start with a bit of the global context, which most of you will know. There's, as we know, an accelerated world of what we refer to as interpolarity, or I prefer the term, which is sort of multipolarity in the age of interdependence, which is more dispersed power, an accelerated shift away from Western cultural, political and economic dominance towards a much more heterogeneous and complicated world, a much more difficult world to manage. Whereas the original G7 produced about 70% of global GDP from 1960 to 2000, by 2050, they will be producing only 30% of GDP, global GDP, while the G20 have been producing about 80% of global GDP since the 1960s, and they will continue to produce about 80% of GDP by 2050. There's also a shift away from government to non-state actors, to civil society, to business and technical agencies, to supranational institutions, transnational networks, and so on. At the same time, we know that there's a deepening interdependence through trade and economic growth, through energy interdependence, potential catastrophic energy and emission forecasts by developing countries on top of the historical emissions by developed countries. Now, this greater complexity defies easy prediction. But the great concern is that we will see that competition is more likely as we see a return of geopolitics, but certainly a much more uncertain world. Just to put this in context, if that is global GDP at purchasing power parity, and you'll see this, I'm going to use this. This is out to 2050. This is where we are, roughly. We're looking at global GDP at purchasing power parity. That will probably double between 2010 and 2030. Just to put this in context of the immense burden that humanity is placing on the planet. So that by 2030, global GDP will be around $110 trillion, up from the $60 trillion. So it doubles literally from about 2010 to 2030. This is amazing. It is scary. It is frightening in terms of the burden we place on the planet. Now, you know, what is driving this? I'm going to speak quite a bit about one set of factors that is really very important, and that is throughout history, population growth and urbanization have been a major factor, probably the major factor in economic growth. And this is how Europe, the United States, China, and India have developed. And there is a very robust relationship between demographic growth, urbanization, and economic growth. If you want a picture, a demographic picture of how the world will change, then this is probably the best. This is a graph of the working age of population, millions of people in 16 to 65 years of age, millions on the left, years at the bottom, and it shows you what is going to happen with Africa, what is happening with India, with India, with China, and Europe and the United States. Now, we are arguing that by 2032, give or take a year or two, 2032, Africa will have a larger working population than China, and by 2036, a larger worker population than India. In 1960, 9% of the world's people lived in Africa, about 15% in 2010. And by 2050, about 23%, one in four people, will be living in Africa. That only stabilizes close to the end of the century. We are already seeing the Chinese growth rates are declining in line with the reductions in the size of their worker age population. India's will, at a later point, although it remains much more dynamic in the years that lie ahead. The United States is traditionally much higher population growth than Europe, which is one of the reasons for your continued economic growth. So that picture, that slide, captures very much, I think, also the future. And by the way, if I did a graph of global so-called material power or hard power, it more or less looks exactly the same. A little bit of a delay, but that's the idea. Now, the thing that is very well known, of course, is this picture, which is what has happened with global conflict. It has declined particularly. This is out to 2006. We see what has happened at the end of the Cold War when total warfare, social warfare, interstate warfare, and there are many disputes about the categorization, but I'm just making the general point in terms of the massive declines of interstate conflict after the end of the Cold War. The reasons, of course, are the end of the Cold War and end of proxy competition, particularly in regions like Africa between the West and the former Soviet Union. But also, there's also other stories here that relate to increased state capacity in much of Africa in particular, so that you are in a better position to suppress opposition, to roll out effective governance. It's not so easy to rebel against the state. There is, of course, also the greater leadership and engagement by the international community, by the African Union in particular, greater leadership and engagement on particularly on African instability that has contributed to the reductions in interstate conflict. And underpinning this, of course, is the quite remarkable change in growth prospects that we've seen in Africa over the last about 10 years. We would argue that these reductions in social turbulence and possibly even interstate war are unlikely to continue into the future for reasons that I'll explain to a degree. Now, in the study that we've done in this monograph, we have divided Africa into five regions, and these are the five regions that I'm going to use to show a few graphs and figures on: Southern, Eastern, Central, West, and North Africa. And these are the basis that we used for our projections. Now, the first interesting picture to emerge from our analysis is simply the rise of East and West Africa. What you see there are population in the size of the absolute population in the various regions, 1960, 2005, 2050, and you see what's happening with East and West Africa, largely because of higher total fertility rates. So by 2050, East and West Africa each have around 700 million people. That's a lot of people, which is about 2.5 times larger than Central, Southern, or North Africa. You also see in the picture that Central Africa, which is the most problematic of the African regions in terms of its current and future, its fertility rates start catching up. So you see that Central Africa relatives also sees quite a relative growth, particularly compared to North and Southern Africa. So let's look a little bit at economic growth. This is one picture of global transformation at GDP at purchasing power parity, which again takes out to 2050. And this is a well-known picture where you can see Africa at the bottom, You can see the EU27, the United States, and of course here you see the amazing, amazing story of China. No guarantee that this is going to carry on, but that is Africa. And this is purchasing power parity. It's not market exchange rates. Now, I've made the point already that there's a robust relationship between urbanization and per capita growth and per capita income, and nearly all countries are become about 50% urbanized before reaching middle income status. And all high income countries are 70 to 80% urbanized. Every scenario that we run, no matter what the quality of governance in Africa, no matter what the level of infrastructure development, of foreign investment, indicates steady growth even in GDP per capita on the continent. Because of our massive population, this only translates quite slowly into GDP per capita growth, but it eventually does. Now, at the moment, GDP per person in Africa is about $900 per person at purchasing power parity, $900. By 2030, we estimate that this will be about $1,760 per person. So it goes from 900 to 1,760, despite the fact that our population goes from 1 billion people to 1.55 billion people. That's amazing. So our GDP per capita almost doubles while our population increases by 50%. This, of course, is far, far less than China or India. And obviously one can't compare Africa with its 53 countries with a single country such as India and China, like I am doing. I mean, it's just, you just can't really do that. But Africa's demographic momentum, high population growth and high urbanization will translate into economic momentum. It is translating into economic momentum. So if you then look at the economic growth in the five regions of Africa that I've set out, we all know that North and Southern Africa are the regions with the highest human development indicators, highest levels of growth, lowest total fertility rates, so therefore they stand out. And we see the extent to which Northern and Southern Africa continue to do better than the rest of the continent. And we see that Central Africa remains, and in all our forecasts, remains a serious, serious challenge. But we see the steady transformation towards higher income. This is the base case. This is where things seem to be going at the moment. It means there's no major interventions in education. There are no major interventions in health provision and so on and so forth. So it's an important story to tell. Now, if you don't believe this model, maybe what you will is you will perhaps believe The Economist and the Economist Intelligence Unit. The Economist find that over the last 10 years from 2010, six of the world's 10 fastest-growing economies were in sub-Saharan Africa: Angola, Nigeria, Ethiopia, Chad, Mozambique, and Rwanda. And the IMF forecasts that Africa will grab 7 of the top 10 places over the next 5 years. That excludes countries with less than 10 million people. So over the next 5 years, African countries that will grow the fastest are Ethiopia, Mozambique, Tanzania, Congo, Ghana, Zambia, and Nigeria. In other words, the average African economy will outpace its Asian counterpart. We're already seeing that. Africa currently is the second fastest-growing region in the world. In a few years, it will be the fastest-growing region in the world. What are the reasons for this counter? Well, if you're in the U.S. and America, this may come as a surprise. It certainly is not a surprise if you're in India or China. But I'll give you 8 reasons for the African growth. Firstly, I've already made the point a number of times, population growth and urbanization. The second is responsible macroeconomic management and reform. There are many examples of this, of the studies of the Ibrahim Foundation, the United Nations Economic Commission for Africa. Bit of a slip there. I should have said the United States IMF or World Bank. That would have made more sense. Steady progress in macroeconomic management and reform doesn't translate into democratic reform necessarily. Improved agricultural output and industrial management, same sources indicate the same, steady improvement. Relatively stable political frameworks, more effective aid, targeted debt relief, and increased domestic revenues. I tend towards the belief, and I think there's a lot to indicate, that the focus that was provided by the Millennium Development Goals have really changed aid effectiveness quite dramatically. And aid is now behind success in Africa. You can see that in a number of countries. Growth in remittances and foreign direct investment. World Bank estimates that we $24 billion remittances by 2012, which is compared to about $8 billion in 2004. Foreign direct investment, we expect that to reach about $150 billion by 2015 per year. This is less than what we had in 2008. But if you look at what happened with FDI in Africa, it took a dip with 2008-2009, but not as big a dip as Asia and elsewhere. And, of course, a very important story, number seven, global economic growth. Demand from China in particular, but also from India, Brazil, and others, is dragging Africa up. And our trade patterns are changing from north-south to south-south. Amazing story. By 2030, about 50% of Africa's trades will probably be with the BRIC countries, we would estimate. That's actually a Standard Bank estimate. So trade patterns are growing. And the best example of this, let's just look at this picture of China-Africa trade from 1995 to 2008. I mean, just if you look at that graph, it's absolutely an amazing story. That is 2008. It was about $107 billion. It has grown 10 times since 2008. We in 2010, last year, it was at $127 billion. So it was there last year. Standard Bank, okay, Standard Bank is owned a third by China. So reckon that it will reach about $300 billion by 2012. 2012 is next year. So it'll be up there. That's amazing. It's absolutely amazing.
Back to your previous slide, because I was trying to get the eight reasons and we only got the six, I think. Unless I missed.
Say again?
I only heard six of the eight reasons.
On the reasons.
Yeah.
Sorry, that one. I'm not discussing all of them. I just sort of listed them. You can have the presentation afterwards as well. I think I've sent it to you guys. So Africa's China's trade with Africa is growing at a rate of about 40% per year. That's a lot. Indian trade with Africa is about $46 billion per year at the moment. We expect it to be about $70 billion by 2015. That's a forecast that came out very recently. And this is sort of bankers that do these forecasts, not me, so don't ask me how they did them, but it really is amazing. Now, most of the time, the argument is made that Africa is growing because of the commodities boom and that the super cycle is driving Africa. Well, it is true. You can take your pick. McKinsey would say it's responsible for about 32% of Africa's growth. UNECA would say it's about 50%. But still, there are two-thirds or half that is responsible for the other half or two-thirds of our growth. What is responsible for that? Even if you accept that commodities is a major growth factor in Africa's growth. So the other seven factors that I've mentioned hold for that. And amongst a few other factors, average return on investment capital in Africa is 2 to 3 times higher than in India, China, Indonesia, and Vietnam for the period 2002-2007. We will shortly be the only major low-wage region. I showed you the population dynamics. Manufacturing will come to Africa. It is already coming to Africa. And a very important factor, we are still unexplored. One estimate, 5 times less explored than the OECD countries. If that is true, we are only at the start of the commodities boom in Africa. Trade patterns are, of course, changing. What is happening is that Europe is sort of being squeezed out of Africa. This is 2009 to 2008. You can see what's happening with Western Europe, going from 51 to 28% of trade. Asia increasing, the U.S. holding its own. So the BRICS, in a sense, are squeezing Europe out of Africa. But it's important that Europe is very, very important for the continent. There are many reasons: proximity, history, as a source of soft power in a global competitive world where we struggle for where the future is. And many Africans are very, very upbeat and positive about China, but China, you can't export what you don't have. China's not a democracy. Won't export, can't export what ordinary Africans want, which is more freedom, which is greater responsibility and ownership of their own lives and so on and so forth. So just to make the point that Europe and the United States and China are the three countries that remain, you know, critically important. And Africa in global power relations is probably sort of a swing region, 54 countries. If you want anything through the UN, to the extent that things need to go through the UN, Africa, critically important. One of the prerequisites, of course, for African growth is that we need to do something about our inter-African trade, which is very low by any standard. And what this shows you is that in Africa, only 12% of our trade is within our regions itself. Regional integration is an absolute prerequisite for African growth. North Africa, it's only 2%, if I'm correct. There's a mistake there. It's only 6%. And given what's happened lately in North Africa, regional integration in North Africa is particularly important as a structural conflict prevention approach. But that is one of the big issues. Regional integration is a prerequisite for accelerated African growth. Now, I've been providing a very good news, upbeat story, and I'm glad that you're all enthusiastic about this. But, of course, there is also another side of the picture, and that is that we are growing at rates that are historically at remarkable levels, but there are many, many challenges. If I show you, for example, this picture, this is the five regions of Africa, and at the top it's the millions of people that still earn less than $1.25 a day. At the bottom part it's a percentage of the population. And you can see there that Central Africa, in actual fact, the absolute number of people increases that live on absolute below $1.25. West Africa doesn't look too good either. Now, generally at the moment, African poverty is declining by about 1% per year. Obviously, we need to work much harder. We need to work much. Much needs to be done to accelerate those trends. But absolute poverty, absolute deprivation remains a huge, huge important on the continent. And having made that point, I think in our view there are sort of five areas of particular concern in Africa, and I'll briefly discuss them. The first is the relationship between religion, poverty, and radicalization, the impact of the fourth wave of democracy, the youth bulge and lack of employment, and impact of climate change and management of – it sort of comes together in the management of urban spaces. Now, this is what's happened with religion in Africa, in sub-Saharan Africa. Those are indigenous religions. This is now from 1900 to 2010. This is Islam, and that is Christianity. This is sub-Saharan Africa. Of course, across the whole of Africa, Islam and Christianity is more or less balanced. Now, and you have a situation now where Africa looks more or less like that, Muslim in the north, Christianity in the south. Now, religion is a source of inspiration and comfort for millions of people. And religion, of course, is not a source of conflict. But given the relationship between poverty, destitution in the global village, and the fact that Africa, for 9 out of 10 Africans, religion is either important or very important in their lives. In other words, Africa is generally about as religious as Pakistan, the whole of Africa, in comparable terms. So that combustible relationship of poverty, the global village effect, where you can see your relative deprivation daily. If you want to watch, if you don't want to watch news, you can watch CNN. If you want to watch news, maybe you can watch Al Jazeera. You can see, because on CNN you see boating and, you know, horse riding, and you can just see the relative your relative deprivation. That is a potentially highly explosive mixture. All terrorism starts locally. And that belt, we think, remains very combustible. So that's the first source of concern that we would say, this relationship. The second is the pressures for democratization after what we would refer to as the fourth wave of democracy. What's happened in North Africa is, of course, quite remarkable. There is no clear relationship between democracy and economic growth from the literature. And so the short-term relationship is debatable. And clearly relationship, democratization has stalled in recent years until what we saw has happened in North Africa now. And Africa remained the least democratic region in the world, second to the Middle East. This may also change in the years that lie ahead. If you look at North Africa, North Africa's got a smaller youth bulge than the rest of Africa. So it's more highly connected and in certain aspects. And we've seen, you all would know about the impact of social media and so on and so forth. At the end of last year, we, together with Pardi, did this graph. And what this graph shows is we took those five regions of Africa and we looked at the so-called democratic deficit in every region. Now, deficit's supposed to be down, but we're not economists, so deficit is up. Okay, so that is the democratic deficit in North Africa at the end of last year. This is based on the Polity4 database. That tells a story of what happened. What is democratic deficit? Democratic deficit is where you expect your level of democracy should be relative to GDP per capita, levels of education, and so on and so forth. So what we saw was that that tension, that bubble, boil has been launched. And the impact across the continent and globally is major. It'll take decades for that situation a decade or more for that situation to stabilize. But the challenges that this present to African leadership and African governance are going to be immense to be able to run ahead of the demands of their people. This third that I mentioned was the youth bulge and the lack of employment opportunities. African growth, we know, is not creating jobs, and it cannot do so without a radical restructuring. We need both manufacturing and we need the Green Revolution. The Green Revolution, I think, is sort of more or less on its way. Manufacturing will take a little bit longer. And clearly we need to bring demographic issues back on the table, total fertility rates and so on and so forth. That's a picture by 2030, of the demographic, what do you call it?
Pyramid.
There we are. The demographic pyramid. The age cohorts on the left from 0 to 100, female, male, and then what this indicates are children, people no education, primary education, secondary education, tertiary education. Now you can see what the challenge. First, just look at the pyramid. This is 2030, 20 years from now. Look at that African pyramid. The United States, which probably has got the most balanced of demographic pyramids globally as a country, you can see what happens with India as it moves beyond its as the Indian population also eventually starts to stabilize. You can see the impact of the one-child policy in China and the dangers and the challenges that face China in the years ahead as it runs out of workers, as its dependency ratios change and so on and so forth. Now, structural unemployment is probably already a feature of the global economy. It will also, in our view, become a feature of the developed world, but it is in Africa. Structural unemployment is a major factor. And how this will play out in Africa is quite debatable. But that massive group of young, largely uneducated or poorly educated Africans are going to present African leadership and Africa with tremendous problems because, you know, young men are the source of most problems in the world and they are the source of crime and other things, and they will be the case also in Africa. The fourth factor is climate change and the links to conflict. Now, we know climate change doesn't really cause conflict, but it is an accelerator. There are four factors. Reduced water supply and growing demand could lead to increased competition between different sectors of society, different communities, and different countries. productions and crop yields and increasingly unpredictable weather patterns around the world will lead to higher food prices for food, greater food insecurity and riots and so on and so forth, changing sea levels. And all of this is accelerated by the poor governance and lack of coping capacity. Rainfall patterns are changing. If you look at that map, it will tell you that rain in southern and north Africa will probably decline, and it will increase in the rest of the continent, central, east, and west Africa. Temperatures are going to increase quite dramatically. I mean, we're heading for the high warming scenario on the IPCC. These are the average changes in temperature expected by the end of the century in Africa. So where I'm staying in Pretoria, about 3.5%, 3.5 degrees warmer. It's going to go up by as much as 7 degrees in certain areas. We know that, and so on and so forth. So major, major changes. We don't really know exactly what the impact is going to be. We're trying to find out. We're trying to discuss. Much of this is going to come together in the challenges of urban space in Africa, management of urban spaces. That's going to be the big challenge. Because by 2030, African growth will bump up against the impact of climate change. And what will happen is that it will accelerate our already high rates of urbanization, that our major adaptation strategies urbanize. That's what's going to be the case. So that this will be a big, big challenge for Africa. And African governments will have to respond accordingly. So that presents quite a turbulent, I think, story for leadership. But it's also quite a positive story, because Africans will no longer accept the quality of leadership that they have had over the last 20, 30 years. You can already see it. Africans will demand, like people all over the world, demand different types of leadership, more accountable leadership. And that's the story what we see in North Africa. To conclude, I've tried to make the argument that the international system will be shaped by redistribution of power at the global level, a deepening of interdependence, resource competition, growth importance of non-state actors, thus greater complexity and heterogeneity. And I've sort of raised some questions about the fourth wave of democracy. What is the implications for the rest of Africa? And, of course, also for countries like China. On the one hand, the conclusions of the 2010 edition of the Human Development Report points to the remarkable progress that we've seen globally. We continue to live in a tremendous era of peace, prosperity, and growth, despite what we see on television. And HDR says is that the past 30 years has seen substantial progress in many aspects of human development. Most people today are healthier, live longer, and more educated, and have more access to goods and services. Even in countries facing adverse economic conditions, people's health and education have greatly improved. And there has been progress not only in improving health and education and raising income, but also in expanding people's power to select leaders, influence public decisions, and share knowledge. This is also true of Africa. At the end of last year, when the World Bank developed its strategy for Africa, it said that Africa could be on the brink of an economic takeoff, much like China was 30 years ago and India 20 years ago. And everything we look at would indicate the same. The world is changing. This is a global material power index that shows the relative shift in global power. Now, what is interesting, according to this, if you keep Africa as one country, then Africa overtakes Europe by about 2044. I think that's hardly likely. What is material power? Material power is population, military expenditure, GDP, and knowledge technology indicator. But those are the global shifts in transitions that we are seeing. So it's an index on a 100-point scale in which the U.S. Starts with about 23% of material power and ends up with about 16% by 2050. And this is this growing multipolarity, interpolarity, and so on. So the global challenge really is how to promote a cooperative form of multipolarity in an era of global competition. We all will have to work much harder in trying to create the global governance institutions that are able to manage this hot, flat, and crowded world. How do we increase the supply of this dwindling global governance at a time of huge international demand and weakening political will? And I've tried to make the argument that the trends in Africa are positive, although bad news sells. Events in Zimbabwe and Darfur present the continent in the worst light possible, but the underlying trends are actually quite remarkably positive. In an era of contestation of global values and power transition, Africa has more agency than ever before. And that the need and demand for democracy will continue to increase. And that, in actual fact, says tough times ahead in terms of social turmoil and this type of stuff. Africans would argue that the developmental state, where the state plays a key role in development after the damage that the structural adjustment programs, the World Bank, the IMF did on Africa, is key. But I think that if you, at the end of that, that's what African leadership wants. And there are a few African countries, Ethiopia, Rwanda, that can go the developmental state route. But if you want the mental picture of how Africa will develop, the mental picture is much more like India than it is like China. It's bottom-up, chaotic, corrupt, despite government, rather than because of government. That's the real picture. The dynamism of Africans, ordinary people, will drive its development. So our challenge is really to transform the African developmental model from jobless growth and capital-intensive extractive industries to the promotion of a green industrialization and an African agricultural revolution. Our view is that Africa is multipolar in the sense that no single country really will dominate the continent. The same material power index that I use, if you apply that to Africa, it would see that four African countries will probably be the most influential in Africa and globally. That would be Ethiopia, Egypt, Nigeria, and South Africa. Now, the extent to which Egypt is an African power is debatable. It sees itself much more as a Middle Eastern power. You'll see the relative decline in the hard power of South Africa, but we have a number of soft power attributes that will keep us at the big table, I think, for many years to come. Sophisticated financial systems, and so on and so forth. And in the final stages, the next stages of this project, we're going to be looking at some alternative scenarios, because what I've presented to you is simply a base case. So, Jennifer, thank you very much.
Great. Thanks very much. There's a whole lot in there, and any one of those trends would be interesting to pursue. I guess we'll open it up for questions right now. I'm glad you ended with that last slide, because I was curious, I mean, about growing inequality within Africa. I mean, clearly, and I was surprised to see Ethiopia way up there too, but you know, it seems like so much of this will be driven, at least in sub-Saharan Africa, by Nigeria, for example, and perhaps South Africa. But I wonder, overall, do the kind of inequalities between states then add new dynamics in terms of regional integration and so forth?
I think it does very much in southern Africa. We have southern Africa faces huge Gini coefficient challenges, more so than any other region. And it's largely because of the relative wealth of South Africa compared to the rest of the region. I can't remember, but I think GDP per capita in South Africa is 30 times what it is in the DRC. I mean, those. And then I think two of the top five Gini coefficients, earlier wrote, our Gini coefficients in Africa are almost as bad as yours in many American cities.
Typical South African jab there.
Yeah, just had to get it. But that is going to face us with huge problems, particularly if you make the argument that regional integration has to happen. We have to integrate to be big enough to be part of the global economy. Now, how does South Africa integrate with the DRC? No, integrate regionally, it's very, very difficult. So I think that's going to be a big factor.
Right. Although you could also see it, those countries driving. I mean, South Africa right now, the investment. I mean, they're a massive investor in the rest of Africa. So in some ways, it's kind of where does the balance come out? Is it a powerful? Is it a positive or ultimate negative? Why don't we open up for questions? If you could introduce yourself, who wants to go first? Yes, the gentleman in the back.
My name is Yaya Fancy. I'm the lead. We don't like to use word like chief or director. I'm the lead person for the Special Operations Division for the United States Africa 2017 project. And thank you very much. If you don't mind, I will recommend when I go that this part become part of the mobilization document for the creation of the United States of Africa 2017. That's all I'm going to say.
Yes, and then Steve.
No, thank you for the presentation. I'm Darius Jonker from the Embassy of South Africa. I understand you launched the monograph along the sidelines of the AU summit earlier this year, and so my question pertains to that launch and just to the rollout of this project from its initial inception and now, and as you go forward. How has it been taken up by governments in Africa, governments in elsewhere, the official DIM in general, the kind of proposals you're advocating for and the like? Have politicians and policymakers been listening?
The reception is, let me first say that we're struggling to raise money for this. This is one of the reasons why I'm in the United States. We've been really running this on a shoestring budget. We have another session from the 4th to the 8th of July in South Africa where we're bringing the IFS people from party over. And one of the days we'll be running a workshop with Durko on the relation. Durko is the South African Department of Foreign Relations, their new name, Department of International Relations and Cooperation, or Cooperation. Yeah. And one of the days will be a seminar looking at the relationship between Europe and Africa, which we're doing with the EU Institute for Security Studies in Paris. And another day will be a workshop with Foreign Affairs looking at the future of the BRICS and Africa, or the BRIC and Africa in this case, because South Africa is obviously part of Africa. The reception, I've presented this and had discussions with NAPAD, the Africa Union Commission. I presented this same presentation at the retreat of the Africa Union's Peace and Security Department 2 weeks ago in Addis. I've given it, I've given many, many variants. Nobody wants to put money on the table, but that's a different issue. The responses are, it depends where you are, what the responses are. African responses are, of course, very positive because generally we are so used to everybody telling us what's wrong with Africa and what Africa should do to develop. And, of course, nothing that they did, but, you know, everything advice to us to do this, and get your governance sorted out, deal with your corruption, and then you will develop. Of course, the history of the world is exactly the other way around, but let's leave that for the time being. But the response is very, very positive. We're trying to translate this into something that you can have a debate amongst African, a real debate amongst African leadership, where we can stop looking at our differences and our problems, but really start looking at the drivers of Africa. Because African leadership is not by any stretch of the imagination as forward-looking as that in Asia and elsewhere, where people really look at what they need to do to make Singapore or whatever more competitive. We just, you know, there are few countries that are doing that. So there's a long, long way to go on the project. I've given these talks a number of times, but the reception is generally very positive. Of course, Europeans, to a lesser degree, Americans, much more skeptical of what you're presenting, because their sort of, you know, vision of Africa's, you know, problems.
We're going to go to Steve, and then David, and then over.
I have never seen a document that's put so much stuff, and it's something you can read with small pages, so compliments on this. There were two things going on in the next month which should be kind of interesting. One, of course, is the AGOA Forum, which will begin the consideration of what AGOA will look like after the current program expires in 2015, And two will be a summit of the tripartite group, which gets to some of the points you have raised. I looked at it, and even though it had every table possible, the one table I was looking for, it didn't have. But I'm just curious. And that is, what is happening to the share of investment or the total investment between China, India, the United States, and Europe? We have a feeling that although the U.S. does many good things with the MCC and others you've mentioned, because of our conditions, perhaps politically good, we're losing a significant share and therefore will not play a role. So I'm curious if you came across, like you did on trade, any divisions on investment. And then the second issue, of course, is regional trade, which you did correctly emphasize. Many of us think that the major problem in regional trade is more to do with infrastructure and the way it was left and less to do with the regional communities. People do a lot of blaming of regional communities, although regional communities do suffer from the fact that even where they created, they still leave the border post in place because they're not sure the money will get collected and so on. So there's border even within SACU. So again, I'm curious if your work has done beyond just saying regional integration is important, if it's looked at specific steps that could be taken between now and 2050 that will make regional trade go up within Africa. And I didn't see a chart, and I might have missed it, which projected how much you thought regional trade could be by 2048, but that might have been it. I just missed it. Thank you.
Thanks very much. I can't answer you on the investment. If I go into the IFS model, I will be able to answer that fairly quickly. I'm a political scientist. I can actually pull that out quite quickly. The figures are there. The calculations are included in the projections that I'm giving you in this dynamic model. And you are entirely, when you turn to the infrastructure issue, entire agreement, and that is where foreign assistance is going, because we recognize that the means for integration, Africa can skip certain technologies through ICT and so on. You know, we don't need fixed lines. We go directly into, and that is happening. As you know, cell phone and internet penetration growth rates in Africa are the highest in the world. They are higher growth rates than China or India from a very low base, but it's just like going like that. But we can skip certain, but the basics, the means for integration is not there. So I don't think you can get around the requirement for regional for also dealing with the political issues. But the problem with African integration has always been, if you look at it from the Africa Union perspective, is that it's a top-down political process and not a bottom-up economic process. I would tend towards the belief that African integration is much more going to be a bottom-up, sub-regionally driven, and then eventually process. And a lot of work needs to be done on African, on both the economic and political issues. But I would completely agree. I should add that IFS with Pardi, with whom we are working, have recently, into this model that we use, built in a very sophisticated infrastructure model that you can literally now map out different scenarios and projections, what the current state was, and where different scenarios and where it is going. And we will be bringing out a little paper shortly that looks at, what is it, the UN report that said our infrastructure deficit is $93 billion. Okay, so let's say somebody invests that $93 billion. You can actually, in fact, look at what the impact will be on African growth. And, of course, it is massive. It's massive, massive, massive. Because our trading patterns have all been, outwards. So our railway lines and everything is really to export our stuff to other places. It's not been to create either a nation state or to create a regional integration to facilitate that. So absolutely, that's where the debate is going. And that's where I also think ODI and everything is going, is to build the infrastructure in every sense of the word to allow for, to unleash the potential of the continent.
Thank you very much. David Throop, CSIS and George Washington University. I found this fascinating. I think you are essentially preaching to the converted, because there have been a whole series of works come out over the last year which have more or less said the same. And if you look at them, it comes down really that it looks to me as though there are two key drivers. First of all is the demographic change. And in particular, that for the next 40 years, compared to the last 50 years, 65% of Africans are going to be in productive, economically productive age cohorts, and only 35% dependent. Whereas from 1960 to 2000, it's been the other way round. And the change has been brought about by the fall in the population increase from 4.3% down to 2.3%. So that's absolutely fundamental. And the second one is commodities and the arrival of the BRICS and China and India and the changing demand for both agricultural produce and Africa's minerals. So I think that on its own, those two factors on its own, means that the next 40 years are going to be fundamentally different from the way we have perceived Africa essentially for the last 50 years. However, having said that, it seems to me that there are two key questions which then arise. The first is that you've dealt in African terms, or indeed in terms of your five regional blocks, and it seems to me that the reality is going to be very different from that. That Steve Radelet, for example, has identified 17 countries that now are on the verge of making it, but there are clearly Paul Collier's absolute bottom billion no-hopers. And therefore, I think you have to disaggregate even your regional blocks to get to what are going to be the political economy dynamics of the next 40 years. That there are certain countries, Cote d'Ivoire, believe it or not, or Ghana or Nigeria or Kenya or Uganda, you know, clearly are on the verge of making it. But there are many others that are not. And when places like Mali and Niger and Chad and Central African Republic don't make it, what are going to be the knock-on effects of their dynamic regional neighbours? Because it's going to be places like Ghana and Cote d'Ivoire and Nigeria that are going to be inundated with migrants. So that, you know, feed that sub-regional dynamic into your equation, and I think it makes your picture much messier. And then the other problem I have is put in the politics, put in African culture. You know, political scientists have talked about neo-patrimonialism, they've talked about the economy of affection, basically the extended family and patronage politics in Africa. I work on Kenya and Ghana, and when I look at those countries, it seems to me clearly, by any criteria, these are potential success stories. But if you actually look at the operation of the political system, however democratic they are, the operation of government development policies are essentially still driven by the politics of patronage. And the politics of patronage, to a certain extent, means the politics of ethnicity. It means the politics of internal social cleavage. And if you factor that into your equation, again, I think it makes it much messier. And I would suggest much more realistic. And so I'm grateful for what you provided. I find it extremely interesting. I hope you are right. But I think it could be messed up in quite a big way by political considerations, by the spillover effects of social disintegration by the societies that don't make it, despite the demographic and commodity boom drivers that underlie the pictures that you've presented.
Make one or two remarks. Just on that, the regions we gave are not the five regions are not RECs or anything, regional economic communities. They simply, we just use those five regions as a, you know, to divide Africa into five regions that make some analytical sense. And McKinsey's and recently the Africa Progress Panel brought out update. McKinsey brought out a very nice graph that looked at different African economies, and I think quite a nice way. And the Africa Progress Panel has updated that recently with also a nice way looking at more diversified economies versus countries emerging from conflict and so on. Actually, very, very nice way of looking at some of the dynamics that you're speaking about. But, you know, the African culture argument, I'm less convinced about, because there have been many efforts at these sort of arguments. You know, Catholics can develop and Protestants, or sorry, Catholics won't develop, Protestants will. And Japan's economic, Japanese culture's inimic to development, same as Ireland, and so on. Over the years, just go back, you can find an explanation for every culture, that it's Arab democracy or Arab development. It's just a contradiction in terms. They hold at a certain period of time. There are certain, that doesn't mean there isn't cultural specificities and nuances, and it's important to recognize that. But I tend towards the view that that as North Africa shows you, there is much more commonality between Africa and the rest of the world and the path to development, and that Africa's path to development is the same path to development that has been followed elsewhere globally. The main factor, and it's a sort of a quaint expression, but I quite like it. I think there's a lot of truth in it. One of the reasons why Africa didn't develop is because we haven't, because in a sense nationalism precedes development, and Africans generally don't believe in Africa. They're starting to, but generally they don't. Let me give you one example. What is, you know, one of the examples people take, Ghana and Indonesia, and say, look what happened with Indonesia, and look what happened with Ghana. Okay, things are changing in Ghana at the moment, but the main reason is how does corruption work in Indonesia and in Ghana? The DRC is normally the example. The reason is Indonesian corrupt resources were reinvested in Indonesia. In the case of Africa, they ended up in well-known American or Swiss bank accounts. And the externalization, it comes. That's why I make the point about belief in Africa. And that's changing. One of the reasons why India is doing so well is because the Indian diaspora have played such a critical role. It's starting to change in Africa. The African diaspora are starting to reinvest in the continent. Africans are not only looking to leave the continent, which many of them simply want to do, get their kids out, get them starting to return to the continent. It'll take a while, but sort of I'm making it a number of ways. I'm sort of making this colonialism and the Cold War froze African boundaries and didn't allow for African state development. But, it's a contested issue, and this is a huge issue of discussion and debate that we can have. I think what I am trying to point out is that the future certainly is going to be quite a rocky and quite a turbulent future, but that certain of those dynamics are quite strong.
Hi, my name is Nolu. I'm a communications and external affairs consultant working most recently with the Africa Center for Strategic Studies and before that here in the Corporate Council on Africa. I wonder, first of all, thanks. It is a fantastic study, and I can't wait to get down into the weeds and really look at some of the detail. I wonder, though, if you could speak more to the role of the Africa Union in regional integration. What do you think they should do? What is the role? And whether or not, since we're looking into this crystal ball here, if it's likely to happen?
Thanks. Africa Union, I do a lot of work with the Africa Union and have over 15 years, 16 years. And I have great affection. Let me first make the point that what's happened in North Africa is going to unblock a lot of issues in the Africa Union. Firstly, the AU summits are at least going to be a day shorter because you don't have to deal with Gaddafi. I mean, you guys have got no idea how destructive this guy is. Destructive, how, you know. It's going to change the dynamics within the Africa Union quite positively. For a while, there's been a sense that the AU itself has been dominated by North Africa, which is the least democratic region, and blah, blah, blah. The Africa Union remains, it's a norm-setting institution, and it is major successes are on peace and security issues. In my view, the challenge really is to move it from focusing on peace and security issues to conflict prevention issues, you know, democracy, governance, human rights issues. And there is an opportunity now with the Africa Union Shared Values Initiative. But the real work, I still think, on economic integration is going to happen at the sub-regional level. It's sort of a prerequisite, I think. Regions have different views. Southern Africa, for example, is much more hesitant about continental integration. They believe very strongly in sub-regional integration first. And they're different views, and they're overlapping regional economic communities and challenges. And you can't get away from the fact that you cannot create an Africa Union that is stronger than its constituent member states. I mean, this is the weakest, poorest continent, and you can't create a super organization that is sort of going to run things in a very efficient way. You know, the Africa Union is not the European Union. It's very different animals. So there's a long road ahead. The Africa Union is tremendously important for Africa, but at its level it needs to carry on with its activities. But I think at the economic and regional integration work, it is really it's much more at the sub-regional level where the progress needs to be made, and that's quite difficult, as you would know. And the AU is strong, as I've said, on norm setting and on conflict management, because that's what the African peace and security architecture is about. But it will never really be able to deal with conflict, post-conflict reconstruction, and even on conflict prevention, which is about democracy, human rights, governance, its role is currently constrained. And the only reason why the peace and security architecture is such a sophisticated system is largely because of the EU. EU has invested 700 million euros in the peace and security architecture, particularly in the African Standby Force. It has enabled Africa to translate the Peace and Security Council protocol into a comprehensive system for conflict prevention management, to a degree post-conflict reconstruction. Other donors and other partners like the US and others have come on board, but really that was when in Mozambique the European Union decided to establish the Stability Fund. It just made all the difference. So a few pointers on that. I think we also just need to look at what's going to happen globally, the sort of the development of a greater regional approach to conflict management, as I think we are already seeing globally develop, whether you're talking about Libya or Cote d'Ivoire, or whichever example you want to use. But Africa Union important, but it's not on itself the solution. A lot more needs to happen. I mean, in various of the other regions.
I think what has to be understood, very simple. The decision for political integration in Africa and regional economic integration is no longer at the top. It's from the bottom. And the proposed constitution that will be held for a referendum to initiate the United States of Africa 2017, I'm just going to give you three agreed aspect in it. You're hearing it now. One, in that proposed United States of Africa, it would have a different name. But we're using that metaphor so you understand we're not talking about African Union or European Union. The voting age, and that will fit with your pyramid that you showed, the voting age is 16 years old. The age that you could stand from office from the local to the federal, from local government to the presidency in the federation, is 21. They are debating a charter that should be entrenched in this proposed constitution that will be put in a referendum. That charter, they will have to accept it in essentially its way it's been proposed. It says for the first 50 years of the existence of the United States of Africa, whatever name that federation will be, 55% of all the jobs from local to the federal level should be held by women. And you remember now, it has to be voted in a referendum. Those three things I told you are my suggestion into the Constitution. I am not like academic. I have a PhD in political economy. I stopped dealing with that in 1984. I worked with the people who developed Latin America in that development as well. I'm always been a mobilizer and action person. And I'm ahead of them because we are developing the Constitution. It's a new way. We don't care what the leaders in Africa think. They are irrelevant. It's now the women and the young people who are going to determine. And they are the ones who are going to lead. So it's have to be clear what we're saying. We're structuring the Constitution so that when it's placed, all African Union have nothing to do but to merge it with the one that we're developing.
Okay.
And the people vote for it.
Okay, thank you.
To respond to, because I think, you know, I can't really respond to how it should develop. I think we all recognize that education, as much as we've spoken about regional integration and infrastructure development and manufacturing and the green revolution, which education, and this graph shows it, remains a huge, huge challenge. You know, the only response I can really give you, and this is a very feeble response, is that in one sense, societies kick up on the leadership and will, to one degree, get the leaders that they deserve. But African leadership is going to be hugely important in the years that lie ahead. And you can see, I mean, a few years ago, you had a coterie of leaders in South Africa, Nigeria, Algeria, to a degree Egypt and Ethiopia, which people thought were the new driving forces in Africa's future. And they've sort of disappeared. And we clearly don't have the forward-looking leadership that we need on the continent. But at the same time, that type of leadership is often much more of a technocratic type of leadership. It's not the kind of philosopher king that Mbeki, for example, tried to portray himself at, which did a lot of good, but also, in my view, did quite a lot of damage. Because the challenges really are getting down and working your way through the challenges. So I can't, you know, I can't really respond to the challenge that you throw out because I don't really have a response. But just to reaffirm the importance. And my argument would be that the demands that are going to come from the urban areas are going to be such that African, you know, a country like Kenya, somebody mentioned Kenya. We have an office in Kenya, so I go there quite regularly. And the challenges of corruption and patronage, I think it was you, in Kenya are just, you know, mind-boggling. Yet it is at the same time such a dynamic economy and private sector. But I mean, government, you know, you just don't know how to deal with it. But I think, you almost feel like you need a real revolution, a real looking into the mirror, a real Kenyan introspection to find a way forward on Kenya. But let me just stop there because I really don't have an adequate response to the issue put on the table, except to acknowledge that it is a major, major issue.
Yeah, actually, this is the most disturbing graph in it all. I mean, because if you're talking about the complexity of issues in whether it's in new technologies, whether it's in navigating this multipolar world and the trade-offs and climate change and mitigating, I mean, this, I don't know what that cutoff is. I can't quite read the graph, but, you know, the point at which higher education is gone, that's over 40 right now.
I mean, this is 2030, and this is in a projection of current year. This is 60, 55, 59.
I mean, that's just alarming in terms of kind of the lumpen proletariat there and this tiny elite and what that might do in terms of internal dynamics within each country. When we struggle, and I think of that in terms of the Seven Revolutions presentation, which lays out these big trade-offs and these big trends and the complexity that leaders have to face that they're not prepared for, and so you need a broader swath within the society that can help inform those choices too. So this to me is a critical one, and it also says something about where perhaps the first interventions might be. Beyond regional integration, you need people who are going to be able to drive the change as well. Anyway, let's take another round. Jerry in the back and then here.
Excellent question and point that you make. I pointed to global trends, which you would all know, more complex world in which corporations and business and mafia all become more powerful, more complicated world. But in Africa, the challenge really is firstly the development of appropriate governance and government systems. That remains absolutely critical, which goes to exactly the point that you are making. And that's why the focus is really on this what Africans like to refer to as the sort of the developmental state, where the state play, and it's sort of a bit of a response to what happened with the structural adjustment programs in the 70s and 80s, where the IFIs argued that the state is corrupt and bad and you know, get this thing out, and NGOs will give money to NGOs and civil society, which, you know, you can't develop that way. The state and state machinery and state systems are absolutely critical to African development. So much of the efforts need to go into building that state capacity. And that state capacity, and I think that there's a lot of evidence on that from the United Nations ECA, Mo Ibrahim Index and others, showing that African state capacity, macroeconomic management capacity and so on is improving. So that is absolutely critical. Without that, you're looking you won't be able to manage these tensions. Those five tensions that I'm referring to. So, I completely agree with the sort of the basic requirement and the argument that you're making.
Thank you very much for being here, and thanks to CISIS for hosting. My name is Maureen Farrell with Booz Allen Hamilton, and I'm working in support of U.S. Africa Command. In your factors that you listed, the one about radicalization, poverty, and religion being intertwined, there's a significant debate about linking radicalization and poverty. And I'm wondering what you would say to those who would counter your argument, saying that there's plenty of poor people in Mexico, for instance, and plenty of other places that don't have any aspirations of blowing themselves up. So how do you respond to those arguments, please? Thank you.
I think the size of the problem and it presents just a complete different order of magnitude. The hopelessness and the destitution that you see in vast, vast areas of Africa, combined with the religious intensity of belief that people are seeking an explanation for their current conditions, I think that is what gives you this very, very potentially destructive, volatile mixture. I've mentioned, internet and other penetration rates, but people are seeking an alternative. People. It sounds very, very, simplistic, the best example probably is what's happening with Boko Haram in Nigeria, where you see this mixture of destitution, and anger, and potential for radicalization. Not radicalization in the global jihad terrorism type of stuff, but the resort to violence by young people, many of them, who have no education or limited education, can see their relative deprivation and know that the only way that they can get a slice of the pie is through a weapon. So it's that combustible mixture. And nobody can predict this type of stuff. It is, it does seem to be something that potentially seems to be rearing its head. People want opportunity, and if that opportunity is not being provided, you see the breakdown of lives that we are seeing, breakdown of family and other structures through the impact of climate change, urbanization. We've always argued that the extended family and so on and so forth will be a major source of stability, but I think with some of these factors, I'm not sure if that's going to hold to that extent. If you look at that pyramid that we show, and the urbanization, so it's one of these arguments that if you ask me to empirically lay it out and lay out all the factors, it's going to be very, in actual fact, quite difficult to do. But I think I think many people don't realize is simply the extent of religious intensity across the continent, which is really quite amazing. And you see these tensions throughout the continent, whether you are in Kenya or in Somalia or in Ethiopia or wherever the case may be, Mali, Nigeria, southern parts of Algeria, and so on and so forth. It's something that we are concerned about. It's not a prediction. It doesn't come. There's no model that's predicting this. It's just this sense of where we think one of the major dangers lie in the next few months that are going to look at certain aspects. But the scenario development is really to try and help you understand the trends more than anything else. But these are the four that we're going to be looking at. What we have to a degree started looking at. But you can, I think the idea really is to get a discussion and a debate going on. You know, what are the prerequisites? What can we do in terms of infrastructure development, regional integration, investment in agriculture, the impact, education. What difference would that make? In terms of some of the trends, but some of the let me stop there. There are different ways to look at African integration. I've made the argument that it really is going to happen at the sub-regional level than elsewhere. And if you look at the map of Africa, let's go to that one. Doesn't matter which one. I mean, just to get a mental picture. The Horn of Africa doesn't have a functioning regional economic community, which is one of the Horn of Africa. Neither does, they've got IGAD, but IGAD is not, it's now starting to move in the direction of regional integration. But unless there is a solution to Somalia and Eritrea, difficult to see that going forward. What has happened in North Africa, which is the Arab Maghreb Union, really has been stuck because of regional animosity. It also has the lowest level of inter-regional trade, as I indicated. The events in North Africa provide an opportunity, I think, to unblock that. Provides a great opportunity, and if strategically, if Europe, which is very concerned on its southern periphery, needs to look at regional integration in North Africa as literally a prerequisite for economic growth, as a prerequisite to getting to alleviating the stresses and strains that events in this part of the world through migration, etc., will place on them. So you can make, because the future of North Africa lies with the Mediterranean Rim. It doesn't lie with the rest of Africa. The future of the Horn lies with the Middle East and the Persian Gulf. It doesn't lie with the rest of Africa. That's where its trade patterns are going. That's where those trade patterns are going. West Africa, it literally needs integration to be part of a global economy. And you can make the argument Southern Africa, the region with the most consolidated African states, but also the most recently liberated region, and therefore a region, countries that are very jealously guard their independence, all of them have different challenges. In all of this, the Central Africa remains the least, the region that receives the least attention is going to present us with the most challenges into the future. But the way forward is really looking firstly at getting SACU going, or a reformed SACU, Southern African Customs Union, then SADC, getting that going with COMESA and the East African Community, so you can have a free trade area running along the eastern southern part of the continent. That is the way to move forward, and you need to move forward in more than rhetoric in terms of regional integration in West Africa. You need to get regional integration going in North Africa. Lots of work to be done. It will be facilitated tremendously by infrastructure developmental projects, which provides the means for that process to go. But there's a long road to go in that process. Even in the East African Community, which nominally sees itself as as having a clear vision towards a, towards political integration.
Gosh, I want to thank you. We're out of time, sorry. I want to thank you, Yaki. As I said, this has been very rich and comprehensive, and there's all kinds of questions I think that we could delve down into. I mean, this idea of forecasting out 40, 50 years, I mean, it's very valuable exercise in terms of the trade-offs that you might make in the shorter term, and I think a valuable exercise country-by-country basis that probably more African leaders and others need to take up on an individual basis in terms of planning and making those trade-offs in the early term. Anyway, I want to thank you very much. Join me in thanking Yaki, and we hope to get you back soon again.